From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, we bring you our weekly report of news and events in the Central and South America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Well, Tony, first, there's the reports that Julian Assange got a document of some kind from the Ecuadorian government. Let's start there.
What seems to have happened is that Assange got a national ID card. And from the reports that I've read, it's not entirely clear whether that is an ID card giving him formal residency in Ecuador. But I don't think it gives him, from the reports I've read, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's now an Ecuadorian citizen, but it's a very important administrative step towards him getting formal Ecuadorian citizenship.
So, and I'm not sure what that does for him unless, you know, maybe they make him suddenly embassy staff or something and put him in a Ecuadorian limo to go to the airport and Britain interdicts him and whatever comes from that.
Yeah, and there's all the complications that would arise for the UK authorities from having to deal with somebody who's an Ecuadorian diplomat, if Ecuador does decide to do that, to right. give Assange diplomatic status, under the Vienna Convention, which is the international legal instrument governing diplomatic relations.
Right.
So between countries, so line, who knows how that might pan out? It's difficult to see. But as you say, it doesn't seem to advance the possibilities in a significant way of Assange finally escaping what is in effect house arrest.
Right, and his situation, of course, is perhaps not as secure as it was before Elena Marina started acting up, basically. I'm trying to figure out how advancing his status, when an act clearly by the Ecuadorian government, how that happens under a condition where, you have at least these contradictions in the political situation inside Ecuador right now.
Yeah, and I think under the government of Rafael Correa, the decision to protect Assange was very popular, especially among his party's supporters, obviously. Whereas the right wing in Ecuador would obviously tend to sympathize with the views of the United States authorities. But, you know, and what's happening in Ecuador is very, very difficult to gauge. How far is Lenin Moreno and his team going to go in rolling back the positions developed over the last 10 years or so by the administration of former President Rafael Correa? I fear that he's going to, in a kind of piecemeal kind of way, in a steady, progressive kind of way, do a lot to kind of create a better relationship from his point of view with the United States and with the right wing generally in the region, and among the measures that Lenin Moreno is likely to take over the next couple of years before his administration ends is to say, Ecuador's interests are not served by continuing our membership of the ALBA framework,
right?
And he'll pull out of that. I think that's a very strong possibility, or even a probability. So what that means, you know, what's he going to do about Julian Assange and the status of Julian Assange? And I don't feel optimistic about that either from the point of view of the basic rights of Julian Assange.
You know, but there's an interesting game there. You know, if you're Moreno and, you know, you start to, right after the election, basically, start moving, you know, away from the revolutionary base that helped put him in place towards the United States, and you find out, oops, there's too strong a reaction at the base for this, so you're going to do it piecemeal. Is it possible maybe the symbology, the optics that go with, to help to calm the situation around Assange and maybe even look like you're going up against the United States over Assange could be used to allow an exit from Alba, for example, or some other things that are real, actual foreign policy goals of the U.S.
That is very much part of the game, isn't it? Yeah. And if you look, and at the moment, and I think Lenin Moreno's main concerns are domestic, and what he's desperately concerned to do is to entrench his power and authority and control,
right,
in terms of domestic politics. Now, to what extent is that going to involve a much more overt relationship with the right-wing political parties in Ecuador and the business interests in Ecuador remains to be seen. And what Lenin Moreno has done as president is use his influence, and almost certainly together with some kind of deal that he's done with the right wing, to use their influence in the judicial system, for example, to ensure that they push through that trial against Jorge Glass, Lenin Moreno's own vice president, with whom he ran on in the election which he won, which made him president. And he betrayed Jorge Glass, just as he's betrayed Rafael Correa. And Jorge Glass was sentenced to 6 years for corruption on the basis of what essentially is circumstantial evidence. There was no, and I've read a lot of the reports about the trial of Jorge Glass for corruption over the last 6-9 months, and I haven't seen a single substantive fact adduced to justify the his sentence of 6 years for corruption.
Right.
And so another accused claimed that Jorge Glass was involved, but there's no other substantive evidence. He's been tried and sentenced on the basis of the word of somebody who was out to save their skin and get a lesser sentence.
Right.
And that's what seems to have happened in the case of Jorge Glass. Of course, he might be guilty, but what I'm saying is that there's no substantive evidence of that. So then, if you look at that in the context of what Moreno is continuing to do, and what Moreno has facilitated as well is now a move against Rafael Correa, because what his administration is doing is assisting an investigation or facilitating an investigation by Ecuador's Controller General, which in theory should be a separate state power in Ecuador, but in practice, that it's never like that, is it? And in the same way that the Supreme Court in the United States, for example, has its political biases based on who gets onto the Supreme Court,
right?
And on the basis of what political support, and it's obvious that these theoretical divisions between the state powers, so much depends on the national context, national history, and what's going on at any given time.
That's right.
So in this case, the Controller General has opened up an investigation against Rafael Correa, not for corruption, but looking at how he managed his deficit spending.
And that's sort of like what they did with Dilma Rousseff. That's right. Yeah, if those bookkeepers and accountants that manufactured that case against Dilma Rousseff ever came to Washington and started parsing the books of the CIA and the Pentagon, they'd have to build more prisons than they got already in the United States, right, just to put all the people that were involved into jail.
Yeah, maybe Trump will open up a case against Barack Obama.
Yeah,
deficit spending while black.
But they got this, the Odebrecht thing. That
Odebrecht scandal was the reason that Jorge Glass ended up involved in that judicial process, because his uncle does seem to have been guilty of having received money from Odebrecht, but there's no substantive case against Jorge Glass apart from that testimony by another of the people accused in that case. So, but I'm going back to this issue of Ecuador's Comptroller General investigating the deficit spending policies of of former President Rafael Correa.
Yeah, again, the connection to Brazil, because that's what they did to Dilma. We'll say it again. It's like, it seems like there's some kind of feedback loop with Brazil here.
Well, yeah, and of course one has to remember that this is U.S.-driven policy, right? Yeah. The Odebrecht case largely resulted from investigations by the United States authorities.
Which I remember also that we had that phone tap of Dilma's phone for a while that came out by Obama. I'm wondering how much of that led to all of this.
Oh yeah, and the respective U.S. embassies, the U.S. ambassadors in these countries, they all work very closely in that kind of context. They'll work closely with the right wing opposition or whoever is their local regional ally to help develop these kind of judicial attacks.
Right,
and that's been very well established in the case of Dilma Rousseff, for example, and also earlier in 2012, I think it was, in the soft coup against Fernando Lugo in Paraguay.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be sure that's part of the U.S. advisors have been assisting the Argentinian authorities in their judicial attack on Cristina Kirchner and members of her government.
You know, I have to wonder how exactly the depth of, sense of irony or absurdity or whatever in people that live in all of these countries and in the region and pretty much outside the United States around the world, that on the one hand, the United States holds itself out as some kind of arbiter of democracy, and on the other hand, they spend almost all their time going from country to country thwarting democratic rule in front of the people live there.
Sure, and this whole series of judicial processes aimed at judicializing politics or politicizing judicial processes, and I don't know which way around it is. It's like chicken and egg, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a strong ideological undercurrent to this, of course, because going back to this move by Ecuador's Comptroller General, perhaps our listeners would understand better, Auditor General, against former President Rafael Correa investigating his deficit spending policies. Obviously, that takes place in a context in which there's a continental struggle between progressive economic policies, progressive social policies, and policies at the service of US and other NATO country corporate elites and local regional corporate elites.
Right.
Because they don't want a government playing any kind of active role in economic policy.
Not one that's beholden to the locals. A government imposed by Wall Street, for example, it's very difficult to term, say, the Pinochet government as a laissez-faire Adam Smith kind of thing, regardless of what kind of games they thought they were playing with the economy. When, you know, they're looking up everyone's, posterior with a flashlight, that is hardly laissez-faire. And so they have no problem with government intrusion and, extensive government regulation and control, but only if the government is an direct agent of themselves and not of the people in the jurisdiction that they're playing. I'm going to be clear on that point.
and also implementing the standard neoliberal policy, privatizing government, opening up the economy for the benefit of U.S. and other foreign investors.
Right.
Austerity programs for the poor.
Right. Well, once they have the microphone connected to the head of the person that, you know, the legislatures, whatever, that are, you know, making policy there, then those are we know those are the policies they want to pursue. So those things just happen as a matter of course. You know, okay, we're in charge. Let's start looting the place. That's basically what goes on.
And that looting image is very, that is what is going on. And you can see, it doesn't matter where you look around the continent. Let's go back to Honduras. One of the things that happened in the wake of the electoral fraud and the scandal around and the protests around the electoral fraud was that the government privatized a lucrative port, San Lorenzo, on Honduras's Pacific coast. Honduras doesn't have a very long Pacific coast, but it's got a quite lucrative port facility at a place called San Lorenzo, and over Christmas they privatized it. Forget about kind of democratic accountability and all that stuff.
Well, let's go to also for a moment to Argentina and remind people. You have Argentina, essentially is bankrupt back 20 years ago now, 25 years ago, whatever. Renegotiate almost all of their debt. There's some that essentially is treated by the world as if it was wiped out in bankruptcy. And that paper is picked up in recognition of its, you know, complete loss of value for pennies on the dollar by some sludge funds, basically. And then they decide to try to collect. They find a compliant judge in New York, if memory serves. But nothing. The government in Argentina says, you know, forget this money. You're not getting it. And the world is completely happy with that and doing business with Argentina regularly. Macri gets elected. Doesn't say anything about that, by the way. And, you know, 10 minutes later, Obama's there picking up a check for $12 billion or whatever it was. You know, they loot. That's, you know, they loot wearing a suit.
Right. No, and Argentina is just one of the more egregious examples, isn't it? And in Argentina
since Macri, yeah.
Mauricio Macri, who survived the Panama Papers scandal involving, I think himself directly, many members of his family.
Right. They had a bank, their own bank, right? They had one of those banks that was doing this business. They were deep in it.
Yeah. So that all got swept under the carpet. And now there's a new corruption scandal. And one of Macri's own companies was $48 million better off as a result of some dodgy sale of, and I think it was, I'm not completely sure of the details, but right. It involved the sale of wind farms using wind technology to generate electricity.
Yeah, it was thin air.
And Macri's company illicitly benefited to the tune of $48 million.
Right. Ain't that handy how those things happen? But, you know, just for people to understand something, I'm going to do the historical context in like 30 seconds. You have a whole continent and a whole region full of people happily living along. They've got ancient civilizations that have sprung up there from the Incas to, you know, all across the region. These guys from Europe, come do what they do best. They come marauding. They start murdering, raping, stealing, everything that's not nailed down. And where it is nailed down, the thing and the nails. And then the people there start struggling, first against the Spanish and Portuguese and Dutch and whomever else, then against primarily the United States. And this all takes place, say, from 1493 till, what time is it yesterday? And in all these different places, the people rise up in Cuba, in a whole bunch of different nations over the period of the last 150 years, really. They free themselves, and the United States comes back in and shackles everything down and replays the looting, and the looting goes on. And so what you're calling progressive governments, the Bolivarian impulse, you know, these independistas that basically see, we want to carve out our own space to live our lives without your hand in my pocket, They are the ones facing these right-wing governments that keep being installed by the United States. That's the context for all the stuff we're talking about, right?
Yeah. I'm 500 years, right?
Yep. Half a millennium.
So, and as you say, and when governments like the Venezuelan government, the Cuban government, the government in Nicaragua, Rafael Correa in Ecuador,
Salvador Allende,
Evo Morales in Bolivia. So there's so many examples.
I'm saying Allende, for example. I mean, because that's where that's the tension. That's how far they'll pull the rope.
Yeah. And of course, it's the inspiration of the Cuban Revolution and the incredible success of the Cuban Revolution in developing its own model despite every kind of attack by the United States and its Western allies, including that military attack back in the Playa Girón, which the Cuban people defeated against great odds.
Yep.
Anyway, that's as you say, that's the context that we're talking about, and if you that is how one has to understand what's going on in Venezuela now. Yep. in Venezuela at the moment, and Nicolas Maduro and his ministerial team successfully negotiated the really vicious attacks that in by the opposition, which in any country, like, imagine what would have happened to political opposition in the United States if they tried to engage in the tactics used by the Venezuelan opposition.
Right.
They either been shot dead or sent to trial, locked up, and the key thrown away.
Right.
No, and that but in Venezuela, and this is also a theme that is constant in our conversations, the foreign media, Western media, portray the opposition as kind of heroic champions of liberty.
Well, we could do some interviews here in the United States on that. Let's ask Malcolm X. Oh, sorry. Let's ask Martin Luther King. Oh, sorry. Let's ask Fred Hampton. Oh, sorry. Oh. Let's ask how many Black Panthers and freedom fighters in the United States. Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leonard Peltier.
Leonard Peltier.
Thousands of others.
Even people like Lynn Stewart.
Right. Okay.
Anybody that puts their heads out over the parapet to do something substantive that might change the political and economic realities in the United States or Western Europe becomes a target.
Yep.
And so in Venezuela, and in despite everything that the opposition terrorist program through it, the Venezuelan authorities, they managed to resist that. They managed to organize three electoral processes that they successfully won with massive popular support.
Yep.
That the opposition had no reply to, and now they're again in 2018. The opposition, on the one hand, they're attacking the government in different ways. And only, I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday, a young member of the National Constituent Assembly, a guy called Tomás Lucena, was murdered by the opposition terrorists.
Yep.
In Venezuela. The Venezuelan authorities are in the process of investigating that. But it seems clear that he was a victim of opposition terrorism.
Now, imagine if he was some CIA guy in Kiev or Tehran, or, you want to make a list. In a leftist uprising somewhere, say Occupy Wall Street, somebody decided to fly a helicopter against the Supreme Court in Washington. What kind of response would there be here?
I'm sure. And it's just so obvious, isn't it?
Yep.
But in the case of Venezuela, there's that going on. And at the same time, the other factions of the opposition are engaged in talks in the Dominican Republic with the Venezuelan government with a view to trying to normalize political relations between the opposition and the government in the country.
Right.
So it's difficult to understand what the overall opposition strategy is. They seem to be completely fractured, with one faction basically being run by Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, who himself is run by the U.S. State Department, and another group that seem to understand that if they don't behave in a
civilized,
in a positive way, they're heading for another massive defeat at the end of the year in Venezuela's presidential elections.
Well, see, you've got the squabbling locally, you know, between these rivals who, you know, want to show up in Washington on payday every week or whatever. You know, they're fighting among themselves. But the big board with the strategy, you know, the battle plan for Venezuela, of course, is in Washington and or in Langley, Virginia, or whatever. But it's up here, and so they're looking at a big thing that includes. You've got the variables in Colombia with, you know, you had a peace treaty, so that kind of tends to put things down. And there was smuggling and border issues and all these things. And, of course, that's where you would send in some, you know, shock troops or whatever to do terrorist assaults from that border. You know, so
which
you had,
they did.
Yep, which, yep, what, right. Okay, so now, so what do you do? Well, while we're working on the political settlement, let's light up Colombia so that we can pretty much operate there at will.
Yeah, in Colombia, the situation doesn't look great. And it's very complicated, made much more complicated by the electoral process for the presidential elections in May.
Like 4 months.
I think, I'm not sure if there are legislative elections at the same time, but the important election there is the presidential election. And the peace process has been a victim of that, because with all the jockeying for position within Colombia's domestic political process, the government has been at a disadvantage because it's been unable to, even if it wanted to, and that's not clear. People just assume that the government would negotiate it in goodwill with the FARC, but I was never convinced by that. And subsequent events have borne out the people who are skeptical about the government's commitment to the peace process.
Right.
Because what's happened is the government, by its own account, through no fault of its own, but rather through domestic political opposition, opposition in the judicial system. The original terms of the peace process have been gutted, and the various absolutely fundamental components of the peace process, for example, the component enabling members of the FARC to participate in activities in the legislature, and the fundamental stuff like that. Has been rolled back by, and the government says, well, it's not our fault, it's somebody else.
Yeah.
But
they're kicking the can down the road, because there are parliamentary elections. I'm looking now, March 11th. So it's actually, you know, 2 months and a couple of weeks ahead of the May 27th presidential election.
Right.
They have all. The entire legislature is up. 102 members of the Senate and 166 members of the House.
Okay.
So the whole government's up for election.
Detail. Yep.
Yeah. So, and a little background on the, you know, political squabble. Basically, Santos and Uribe over the peace treaty.
Yeah, but in Colombia's right wing, a very powerful. They've got a very powerful political control in Colombia's legislature. Álvaro Uribe and his extreme right wing group. Have their bloc. Juan Manuel Santos, up until a few months ago, had a fairly solid bloc. But once the whole electoral process began, Juan Manuel Santos's bloc began to fracture.
Right.
As rivals emerged, angling to get the presidential candidacy of that particular block of opinion. And if you look at the people going into the election for the presidential campaign, and there's something like 10 or 12 candidates.
Right. And I assume that each nuanced position with respect to the treaty, either pro or con, can be your marketing position for a candidate. All right, we're going to have to stop there because we're out of time. Tony, thank you very much. And we'll keep our eye on the ball and speak with you again next week.
Okay. Thanks a million, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.